Plant Nutrition Institute and Vice President of the Americas and Research and Phosphorus Program Director in Guelph, Ontario. Thank you for coming. His education is also a nexus. Felt like those first talks were nexus of below ground and above ground and the importance of both of them. His education involves agriculture, crop science, and soil science, and he's a fellow of ASA, CSSA, and the Canadian Society of Agronomy. And he's here to discuss an overview and update of key aspects of plant nutrition to impact human mineral nutrition. So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I just couldn't wait to hear what my nexus was.
That's according to your website.
Thank you. Yes. I'll just add one slight change, I guess, is that, you know, I'm focused here today on 4R plant nutrition for human nutrition. And I've worked in the northeastern corner of North America for what was formerly known as the Potash and Phosphate Institute and became the International Plant Nutrition Institute. For a couple of years, I focused on phosphorus, and recently I'm covering the Americas for IPNI. What I'm talking on today, and IPNI is a organization, not-for-profit research and education organization that's supported by producers of primary fertilizers. I want to emphasize that it doesn't mean that I'm going to just focus on macronutrients for that reason. What I'm hoping to do is broaden out the symposium to some degree. I realized I was following Dr. Chakmak and Dr. Brzezinski, and who can speak to zinc and iodine and iron a whole lot better than I can. I underscore that those are extremely important nutrients to be working on, so don't take from my presentation by the fact that I'm focusing on other nutrients that those aren't important. I want to focus on some definitions of human health, food and nutrition security, because I think that's important to put in our scope as agronomists as we work on this topic. Then I'm going to look at the question about do minerals decline as yields increase, because I think there's a great deal of uncertainty in that question that still remains, yet there are indications that indeed minerals are declining and it is something important that we need to pay attention to. I'll give a few examples of the roles of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, and then I'll talk a little bit about directing 4R, plant nutrition, to the right cropping system, which is really an expansion of just a narrow focus. So the way we illustrate this here, when we talk about 4R plant nutrition, we're focused on source, rate, time, and place, but the key word for me is right. And right isn't defined by just somebody prescribing just a certain combination of those four. It's ensuring that the combination of those four moves the cropping system, that circle in which it's embedded, to be more sustainable, the greater circle of benefits to all humanity. And when we look at the definition of health from the WHO, the short definition there is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being. We recognize that this is, it's a very comprehensive thing, depending not only on what people eat, but their livelihoods and their environment as well. So for our stewardship, something aimed at economic, environmental, and social benefits links in very well with human health. A few years ago, about 5 years ago, we released a book called Fertilizing Crops to Improve Human Health. And thanking again Zach and Mary for inviting me here, I'm guessing that this book is probably the reason why I got invited to speak here. I had the pleasure of serving on the editorial committee, and Dr. Chakmak contributed heavily to this book as well. It includes 11 different chapters, and I'm only drawing a few smatterings of examples from that book that relate to this topic. I want to also look at the definitions of food and nutrition security, because that goes a lot beyond what we tend to think of as, adequate nutrition as well. Food security exists when all people at all times have physical, social, and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food to meet dietary needs, food preferences, and an active and healthy life. That goes a lot beyond, you know, a lot of what we talk about in agriculture, but yet it's all relevant to what we produce in agriculture. And then when we look specifically at a definition that's been emphasized more by the FAO in recent years, food and nutrition security, they look at it as a triple burden. There's a good part of the world yet that still has insufficient intake of dietary energy, hunger, and protein. Then there's the micronutrient deficiency area. And then there's the area of excess intake of dietary energy. And I think in agriculture, we need to start looking at and taking more responsibility for that as well. And one of the other book's co-editors, Dr. Ross Welch from Cornell, was a strong influence in my thinking, I guess, on that topic. Pulling together some data, these are the best FAO and fertilizer industry data on what we've done. You see the green line there going up over time. That's cereal production worldwide. And we seem to be continuing to increase that. That's a good thing. As you see by the declining solid red line there, the number of people considered undernourished, or the percentage of the world's population, has been declining steadily up to the year 2014. It's a preliminary figure yet, but the FAO has released its 2016 figure, suggesting that there may be a slight uptick again. So it's not gone away. We're down to around 11% undernourished, but it's a declining percentage of an increasing number of people in the world. And it's still 800 million, and that is something to be taken seriously. The blue line indicates the worldwide consumption of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium fertilizers. You can see that has been increasing as well, and that is part, but not all, of the explanation for increased cereal production worldwide. And then we don't have as detailed a statistic on obesity, but the FAO's estimate for the global percentage of people who are in an obese condition, that has increased dramatically since the mid-70s to more recently to 13% of the world's population. And you can attribute, obesity has many and complex factors driving it, but many are attributing it to producing too much of the wrong ingredients, making them too available. Maybe we focused a little bit too much on producing simple carbohydrates and sugars, and not enough on getting diversity in the diet. And I guess I'm going to be making an argument that our experiences in 4R nutrient stewardship, where we're working with dealers, agri-retail sector, the crop advisors of the American Society of Agronomy, to address more than just plain simple year-over-year profit for growers, it's more to establish and derive value from changing the system, changing the rules of the game, so that farmers can address both production and environmental issues and be rewarded for producing some ecosystem services as well. We can expand that concept as well to seeing the people who are in the agricultural production system, in the food supply chain, the people who are in the agricultural input supply chain, as working towards establishing crop rotations that achieve better and more beneficial human health. There have been a recent number of reviews of mineral decline, and a few of them fairly alarmist, where they looked at published studies or published charts from dietary organizations over time, and then looked at, you know, published values for nutrient contents in food. And some of them published some rather alarming declines, and they were attributed to, in some cases, that intensive farming is depleting soils of minerals, and this is why there are fewer minerals in the food today. In Canada, there was a recent review, very thorough, published by a fellow by the name of Robin J. Marles, and looking at and reviewing all these reviews, and pointed out some interesting facts. That he pointed out that it's fairly plausible that owing to higher crop yields and new cultivars, some minerals in foods have declined over time. But we're fairly uncertain as to how much, because we don't have systematic monitoring of the of the foods as produced. I'll show you some data, but a lot of it is derived from specific studies of cultivars, not necessarily in the production situation. this review also put in the common sense statement that, you know, you can point to some alarming declines of some very unimportant nutrients, because not all crops are important for nutrients. It's the crops that supply the bulk of the nutrient that you really need to be looking at. So the benefits of increased yield to supply food for expanding populations outweigh the small nutrient dilution effects that are addressed by eating recommended daily servings of vegetables, fruits, and whole grains. Again, underscoring the need for the agricultural industry as a whole, and agronomists in particular, for encouraging diversity in crop rotation. The caveat of that whole analysis is it didn't address the topic of bioavailability, and I think that was important as well. So, I have limited time. I wanted to review some studies on, I've been looking for data. I haven't seen data on production levels of, you know, corn across North America. We suspect it contains a lot less protein today than it used to. These studies, I'll put a caveat out there, all of these studies are looking at the year of release of a corn hybrid and the average protein it tends to contain when we harvest it. Some of the studies are all done recently. Some of them are reviews of data from over a longer period of time. The first is by Don Duvick and Ken Kassman, published quite a long time ago in 1999, and they found a decline from approximately just over 10% to well under 9% crude protein in the corn. A more recent study by Sarah Mueller and Tony Vine did a thorough meta-analysis of a large number of studies published in the literature, again looking at year of release of hybrid and the protein content, and they divided it up into two categories, pre-1990 release and subsequent to that. And you see by the gray line and the green line the difference, the reduction there of more than a full percent in grain protein. Another study by Chen and Vine looked very specifically at year of release for one company's hybrids over time, and found not much decline, especially if you take in those last 2 years. If you fitted a regression line there, you wouldn't get much. But I also had the good fortune of running into Tony Vine just as I came in for these meetings on Sunday, and he noted that he has some unpublished data from another company, where it's a very different trend. So that's fascinating stuff. We're not paying a whole lot of attention to it, and possibly we should be. The caveat of is this important? When I've raised this to a lot of the grain industry, where they're talking, or the feed industry, they often shrug. Corn for them is energy in the livestock diet, and any decline in protein will buy a few more soybeans. So we really have to question how important this is as well. We do know that in wheat, in corn, the optimum rate for protein production is higher than the optimum rate for yield. So when we're starting to fine-tune nitrogen, we need to do a lot more to fine-tune and get to closer to the optimum rate. If we get close to the optimum rate in yield, we will likely, again, be reducing protein concentrations, and that needs to be considered. In that the book that I showed you, we were searching for examples to support the hypothesis, and I guess this is probably not a very scientific approach, but my hypothesis starting out was well-fertilized plants contain good levels of nutrients for people. And this is one study that supported it very well. Even though it was a pot study, they looked at varying levels, very controlled conditions of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and sulfur for potato. And this is not even the complete set of treatments in the experiment. But it was very interesting to note that if you look at that first column, the three highlighted ones with the highest yields, those nutrient combinations yielded generally very good levels of starch, good levels of protein with one exception, and better biological value of the protein. And in this case, I believe, I'm no nutritional expert, but I certainly have understand from nutritionists that potato protein, even though it's not a very high protein crop, are an important source of protein in the diet because it is high quality protein. You can see as well the treatment indicated here, where potassium levels were very low, the dramatic effect of potassium on yield, resulting in increased protein concentration, but poorer protein biological value. So dramatic effects can take place just because of these macronutrients. Potassium has many other roles as well, improving functional quality of fruits and vegetables. I won't go over all the details, but certainly in muskmelons, grapefruit, banana, we know it has many other compounds that are related to health. We've done research looking at isoflavones in soybeans and showed that a potassium-deficient soybean has lower isoflavone concentrations as well. Phytic acid, I think Ismail did a great job of explaining how phytic acid can act as an anti-nutrient. Ross Welch notes that promoters that can counter the anti-nutrient effect of phytic acid, and things like ascorbic acid, citrate, amino acids, peptides, and inulin and prebiotics are aspects of crop that can be bred for that are under simpler genetic control and can influence the bioavailability of other minerals in foods. We recently, within IPNI, hosted a conference on potassium, and there were a number of researchers who pointed out that potassium is a shortfall nutrient. The dietary guideline for North America is 4,700 milligrams per day of potassium intake, and as you can see by these numbers in this chart, the estimated intake for people of what people are actually achieving falls far below that level, and it's even lower yet in Asia. 3% of Americans meet the recommended intake, and yet there are data that show that potassium intake does indeed relate to risk of very important health issues like cardiovascular disease, and that the ratio of potassium and sodium can be even more important. We need more research on this because if this is really true, we really need to take it seriously and get more potassium in the diet. Of course, every crop is not going to be a source of potassium. There are crops that are rich in potassium, and it makes if you want to change the potassium in your diet, changing to a different source is a lot easier than looking for grains that might be enriched in potassium. We pointed out in the book as well, with the Green Revolution in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, developing countries, cereal production increased by a much larger fraction than pulse production. And in fact, the interesting thing was world population increase was less than the cereal production increase, but it was greater than the pulse production. So there are fewer pulses in the diet, and challenging that was difficult. I had some personal experience for a few years working in the country of Bangladesh. We were trying to introduce the crop of soybeans there, and we were competing with rice production. Wherever irrigation was made available in those days in the 1980s, farmers would choose to grow rice because there was such a reliable market for it. Soybeans was a new and introduced crop. Really encouraging fact was when I went back in 2014 to visit, soybeans are now an FAO listed crop for Bangladesh, and a few farmers told me that some farmers are quitting rice production to grow soybeans. It's not taking over the country yet by any means, it's still only 40,000 hectares or so, but it's very interesting to see that happen. The driver here is not necessarily directly human nutrition. The soybeans are now in demand there because of the fact that the poultry production market has developed. But a good number of these farmers were eating at least a small percentage of what they grew and gaining nutrition from the soybeans. So my key points: plant nutrition stewardship has important impacts on human nutrition. We need more systematic measuring of the mineral nutrients in harvested crops, and that can benefit both plant production systems and human nutrition. And applying 4R to the right cropping system is a key to capturing greater value for managing plant nutrition for human nutrition. Thank you.
we have time for a couple questions.
We do. Great.
What do you think about the, people is mainly eating protein sources from animals, and each time we see more deficiency from nutrients in humans, but we do not increase the consumption of vegetables. You presented in the graph, tuna is the only animal source for potassium, the reliable. Then we're everything vegetable.
That's a great question. If the question is, you know, what are we doing to promote more vegetable consumption to improve human nutrition? And, as an agronomist, I often feel that's outside of my sphere of influence. But I think we need to be talking to and working with people who are working in human nutrition. Thanks.
One of the things that I wonder as a wheat geneticist is thinking about breeding for nutritional quality analogous to breeding for drought tolerance or heat stress. Would I do better to breed under deficiency or under sufficiency?
The question is whether to breed under deficiency of mineral nutrients or sufficiency. That's a complex question, and one that I think I addressed that in my PhD. I had lots of arguments with one of my committee members who was a plant breeder, and I was doing research on nitrogen cycling at the time, and she was doing selections under very low soil nitrogen conditions. From the perspective of someone working on sustainable plant production systems, if you work under really nutrient-limiting conditions, you're making the presumption that you have no resources to change that condition, or for some reason you want to maintain that condition. Breeding for extracting more and more out of the soil leads only to more nutrient-depleted soils in the long term. So in some situations, yes, it can be appropriate. The other interesting fact is that despite the fact that most breeders in North America for corn have been breeding under nutrient non-limiting conditions, but breeding also under high stress conditions, but the stress they induced was crowding the plants closer together and growing in multiple environments and selecting with very, very, very massive selection pressure. And what it's led to in terms of the physiology is a corn that's not only higher yielding, but it's also shifted its nitrogen uptake to later in the season, and as a result has become more nitrogen use efficient, and we have demonstrated we can grow corn on far less nitrogen than we used to 30 years ago. Louis, thank you.
Yeah, so this problem of obesity is getting very serious in my opinion, and it's a very controversial issue because people of course have the freedom to choose to do whatever they want. But of course, then it impacts their health, it impacts, the cost because they need treatment and everything. So although it's controversial, we need to start talking and discussing. I mean, what is your opinion of the challenge we have and what can be done?
Well, so the question is, what's my opinion of the obesity challenge and how can we address it? I think, we have to... I would have to confess that as an agronomist, the thing that always excited me was I was into corn, I was into nitrogen, and I was into maximizing yield. And I think maybe we need to just broaden our minds. That's the agronomic part. Then we probably need dialogue with people working in the human nutrition fields, possibly people working in the sociological fields, because there are social factors and other factors that lead to this condition as well. And then see what opportunities there are. Thank you.
Thank our speaker one more time.